Because of the overflow crowd, the hotel management requested that we delay our start of the meeting this noon. In order not to penalize our speaker, however, even though it means we will be a few minutes late in adjournment, we have asked him to deliver his full address and use the full time. The luncheon committee has decided to adopt the custom of announcing the program of the following week at each Friday's luncheon. Next week's speaker will be Colonel Francis V. Kiesling, Jr. His subject will be The Veteran Faces the Future. Our speaker today is a young man who has carved a sizable niche in the Hall of Fame. His life story would provide perfect source material for bestseller travel and adventure novels. Still several years on the sunny side of 40, we wonder what the future holds for him if it is true that life begins at 40. Graduated from high school at the age of 14, Paul Smith chose to continue his schooling in the University of Hard Knocks. He toured the country by hopping freight trains and hitchhiking. He worked as a lumberjack, a coal miner, a cabin boy on freighters, and as a longshoreman. Inspired by his compelling interest in people, he acquired a liberal education. At the age of 19, Mr. Smith entered the investment banking business in San Francisco. His thirst for travel and adventure and knowledge was insatiable, however, so 2 years later, he left this field and started on a tour of Europe, where for the next 2 years, he was a freelance journalist. In 1933, he returned to San Francisco, became financial editor of the Chronicle, then executive editor, and in 1937, editor and general manager, which position he still occupies. In 1938, our speaker enjoyed the unique experience of touring Europe as the traveling companion and consultant of former President Herbert Hoover. Upon his return, he prophesied that war would break out within from 1 to 5 years. A lieutenant commander in Naval Reserve, Paul Smith was ordered to active duty on the day the Japanese attacked at Pearl Harbor. After a year, bored with inaction in Washington, he resigned his naval commission and enlisted as a private in the Marine Corps.
I like to think I'm not naive enough to believe that all men can be brought to agree with all other men on all matters affecting the conception of their interests for all time. We cannot produce an enduring meeting of minds that will last permanently without change through the atomic age or any other age. That is the fallacy of the conventional system of alliances. What shall we strive to produce, then, in its place? I have to repeat, a science of life, a system of life, a machinery of life regulated by conscience, which will produce dynamic solutions of the dynamic problems which constantly arise from the other ever-changing conditions of life. This leads me to one ultimate conclusion from a long-range point of view. This conclusion is our high-priority target. I believe that we must strive to produce a super world organization chosen by free men bound together in free states of intelligently limited sovereignty, similar to that perhaps which draws the line between state and federal power in our own American Federation of Free States, the United States of America. We must head toward the development of a United States of the world, which will embrace both former friends and former enemies, and which, through a federation of limited sovereignties, offer an equality of opportunity and freedom of spirit to all men, white, black, yellow, and brown. While continuing to strive for the actual fulfillment of the spirit of the United Nations Charter conceived in this city, we must even now seek the basis for an extension of the United Nations concept in line with the full significance of the new age of science. We must move toward a world organization with a world conscience expressed probably in a world constitution. I know there's room for argument, but I say there's room for argument only as to method, only as to implementation, not as to desirability of objective. Today there's time to touch only lightly upon implementation. Can you bear with me while I undertake a little further exposition? I contend that no full discussion of today or tomorrow can be held anywhere or at any level, save that it be held within the shadow of the atomic bomb. Some of the thinking that yesteryear might have been put down as vague idealism has this year become basic, elemental, realistic, and urgently necessary to the very survival of the so-called civilized people of the world. I've already said in the newspaper during the 4 weeks I've been back on the job, we must not freeze our intellects, our energies, our spirits in fear of the atomic bomb. I've meant by that we must realize fully its potential, that we must strive to admit courageously the terrifying scope of its possibilities. But rather than freeze an awesome and futile fear of its obvious hazards, we must shut fear from our minds and our hearts and proceed courageously, energetically, and with determination toward a solution of the problems it poses. I know that many of the traditional-minded professional military men disagree, but I'm convinced that there is no defense against the atomic weapon other than a durable peace. No defense but a durable peace. The military expert who takes naive comfort in the recollection that historically all weapons have produced their effective defense misses completely the significance of the atomic weapon, the significance of the process called nuclear fission. I'm one of the few Americans, particularly one of the few newspaper men at large, who is not an expert on the atomic bomb itself. However, I'm also one of the few who has walked amidst the ruins of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. I've seen the crystallized residue, the slag, of the molten lava to which men's works and men's bodies were reduced. I've been where the heart of a whole modern city melted down to run away to oblivion into the small crevices of the earth. I've seen the tangled wreckage of a huge modern steel plant 10 miles from the point of detonation of an atomic bomb. I'm impressed. And it's by the merest accident, gentlemen, that we came into possession of the weapon first. I also know something of the things that have been going on in electronics and jet propulsion. I know that what can be done by these is, in combination with the atomic weapon, is beyond the scope of our imaginations. In this war, the atomic bomb could not be delivered to the target until we had fought our way by traditional methods to within conventional airplane range of the target. I can't prove, partly because it's not now feasible to publicize the evidence, but I feel I know that in view of what is at this moment going on in the field of military research, that limitation will not much longer prevail. I believe, for example, that people are not talking through their hats when they envision atomic explosions conveyed by robot-piloted rockets over ranges of several thousand miles. So again, I insist that against this menace, there is no defense except a durable peace. In order to build a durable peace, we must remove the basic causes of war: colonialism, exploitation, inequality of economic standard, maldistribution of world resources. In order to remove the basic causes of war, we must face revision of our whole concept of our own sovereignty and of the world's political, social, and economic organization. And in order to ensure that the benefits of revision shall be spread over the earth, we must seek to establish a world organization which can turn the knowledge of science to the benefit of all men, with a view to attacking under global law the problem of producing power enough and resources enough for all. We must, under a world constitution, through such a super agency, turn atomic energy to the task of producing enough food and enough goods for all the world. I insist this can be done given the proper pattern of human behavior. We must realize that the secret of the sun has been found by man on earth. We must realize that the men of science have given us a power to change the whole face of the earth, a power that can build a civilization that is beyond our present capacity to imagine. or that can destroy our existing primitive civilization so thoroughly that man could never again rise on the earth. I'm not under the illusion that we can produce this solution overnight or by the wave of a wand. The problem is urgent, but it must take many years to solve it. Our struggle toward the solution involves, first, the creation of a world conscience, the creation of a soul or the recreation of a soul in each and all of us. As someone has already said, a world state without a world conscience can be world tyranny. World peace needs not only form, but substance. We must maintain at least the form of our present peace, precarious as it may be. We must do first things first in order to give it substance. Let's consider the possible steps towards such a far-reaching goal. We live in San Francisco and California and in the United States. The United States is a small but powerful and extremely rich portion of the world. It's here at home that we must first strive to set our house in order while leaving a portion of our intellectual and moral energy free to evolve our American proposals for the implementation of world security. Each of us has an immediate job. Our understanding of our job must be related to an understanding of ourselves in relation to each other and in relation to the other peoples of the world. We must create and produce goods and services for effective distribution over the globe. We must find the means of living with each other in productive harmony before we can preach about the urgent necessity of all peoples living in productive harmony with each other. We must bring into being a national soul, a national conscience, a Native American morality to offer the world. This conscience must be rooted in the idea that free institutions must be actively promoted. In the creation of an American conscience compatible with the age of science, we must re-examine our philosophies, our credos, our prejudices, our very notions of the nature of the earth and the nature of man. We can have no time for people who tell us despairingly that you cannot change human nature. I insist that we must change human nature, or eventually suffer the razing of our cities, the destruction of our factories, the destruction of our culture, and the violent murder of most, if not all, of our people. We cannot play our part in producing a brave new world unless we produce within ourselves a brave new individual. Within our city, a brave new city. Within our state, a brave new state. And within our nation, a strong, productive people capable of courageously advancing toward the ideal in cooperation with the other peoples of the world. I know we're all aware of the existence of three dominant ideas in the world today. One is the idea of organization and discipline in behalf of supranationalism, which was recently carried to an extent in Germany that produced the Nazi state. The second is the idea that you can advance the communal interest by organized, highly disciplined collectivism. The third major idea is the idea that private enterprise and individual freedom offer the productive, secure, and free way of life. Now, there are many modifications of these three dominant ideas. The main job ahead of us is to reconcile all three by means other than physical conflict. We must bear in mind that the objective of the reconciliation is freedom for all men under law, that the objective is the advance of human dignity over the earth. If we succeed in affirming it here, if we succeed in implementing it at home, then we will have a chance to reconcile our concept with the concepts of other people. We must not set ourselves up in irrevocable opposition to any other people's ideas or ideals, so long as they keep them over there. We must seek through the ultimate creation of a world government the means of reconciling their ideals with ours, so that we may live together in peace without armed conflict. Here in the western part of the United States, we're young, energetic, and possess the power of great wealth. Here we live at the edge of the Pacific, the most important communications facility in the modern world. About 30 million of us here in the western portion of the United States live within 1,000 miles of the waters of the Pacific Ocean. We have breathing space on limited resources, which, when labor is added, spells wealth. Also living within 1,000 miles of the waters of the Pacific are approximately 1,200,000,000 other people. you don't think we have great wealth here, let me assure you that there are about 1 billion people who live within the same distance from the waters of the Pacific as we do, who would take the life of another human being today in exchange for the scraps of food we left on our luncheon plates. We must use the energy of our wealth and our unlimited ability to create more wealth for the elimination of strife among ourselves and amongst other men. Now, as I've suggested, the campaign for our objectives must have its beginning on the most accessible front. The most accessible front for us is right here at home, both as individual American citizens and collectively as American citizens of the world. We must strive to resolve our own problems. May I suggest several points of a possible approach? Perhaps you will be surprised at what I am going to put first. First, we must adopt, here and now, individually and collectively, a new pattern of good manners. A very great many of our troubles today arise from our rudeness. This rudeness is to be found in every nook and cranny of America. The children apparently are not taught good manners. The motorist is ill-mannered. The pedestrian is ill-mannered. The butcher, the baker, and his customers are ill-mannered. Now, I'm serious. This condition has a very great and a very profound bearing upon the hazards of the atomic age, because the atomic bomb is a danger itself only when mixed with an explosive human behaviorism. The most noteworthy element in the life of the German state during the early rise of Hitler was the bad manners of the people. It is the very first step in the evolution of an irrational pattern of human behavior. Let us thoroughly resolve to overhaul our manners as individuals and as a nation, because fundamentally, good manners are nothing more involved than simple, decent consideration of the rights of the other fellow. Secondly, we must strengthen our domestic economy if we are to lead in the struggle for a durable peace. We must create and produce a high standard of life within our own country and must find the means to produce surplus goods for the most effective distribution over the widest possible portions of the earth. We must not live in indolence upon our own fat at any time. We must evolve a strong, productive domestic economy, guided by sound liberal purpose and sparked by private capital and individual enterprise.